The Guardian. This is the crackle of pistol shrimp and the occasional grunt of cod. It's just one of many strange, intriguing, and maybe a little bit creepy sounds that resonate from the deep in this new three-part series made for Science Weekly. Throughout the series, the world-renowned sound recordist Chris Watson will be dipping his special underwater microphones, called hydrophones, into rock pools, fjords, and oceans. We'll listen in to the sound and science of underwater life and find out how increasing noise pollution may affect our oceans. Because arresting pictures of plastic washed up on our beaches have caught our attention, but the consequences of a noisy ocean on how creatures migrate, mate, and hunt have not. Noise pollution and its effects on nature remain in the murky depths of public consciousness. And so this series offers a chance to eavesdrop on this watery world. I'm Greg Jackson, and this is episode one of Oceans of Noise. Over to Chris.
I'm Chris Watson, a wildlife sound recordist who has a passion for recording animals and their habitats around the world, on land and in the oceans. That rhythmic scratching sound is the first thing I recorded underwater, and I know now that it's a limpet grazing on a rock. I've come here to record at one of my favourite coastal locations in northeast England. I'm on the basalt rocks of the Great Wind Sill at low tide. And it's perfect here because the sea withdraws and leaves clear pools of water that I can access with my hydrophones. Years ago, when I first came to this place, I thought that the rock pools would be soundless worlds, a silent inner space. But when I dropped a hydrophone into the water, I was just blown away. The pools were revealed as rich whirls of sound, full of squeaks, whirs, and pops. In this series of podcasts from The Guardian, I'm going to be exploring the sounds of the ocean. From a personal point of view, recording the songs and signals made by marine life, as well as talking to people about the growing realization of a developing crisis under the ocean's surface, noise pollution. It's a vital issue because everything in the ocean lives in a world of sound and vibration. And we're putting uncontrolled noise into the largest and most sound-rich habitat on the planet.
The ocean is an ensonifying environment. It's full of sounds.
And then occasionally there's noises, you just don't know what they are.
Vroom!
You hear them and you think, goodness me, what on earth was that?
This beautiful dance when they spiraling up towards the surface and they make this rumbling sound.
The sensation in my body.
You know it's resonating right through our oceans.
It goes like.
So many strange sounds, really remarkable sounds.
You stare into the dark, you can't see anything, but you just hear
low, deep sound that sort of kind of goes straight to your heart and you feel it on the inside of your body.
You can't help but think, my goodness, they can produce any sound they want. They're just jazz musicians.
Our first experience of sound is through the amniotic fluid within our mother's womb. So sound in a liquid is at the origins of human life. Yet the idea of sound in the seas and oceans is still a mysterious idea to many of us. But one thing we are starting to understand as we slowly learn more about this sonic sea world is just how fundamental sound is to all life below the surface of the ocean.
I think It's hard for us to comprehend the importance of water as an acoustic medium, really. And therefore, it's hard for us to understand the importance of sound as a signal in the sea.
Marine biologist Lucille Chapuis from the University of Exeter explains just how sound travels through water.
So sound waves, they can travel through any substances, any medium if you want. But the way sound will travel will differ in air compared with water because of the difference in the physics of this medium. Water is much less compressible than air. It's actually 15,000 times less compressible than air. And since the water is less compressible, there'll be much less of the energy of the sound wave that is leached off in the water when it travels. And all this means that overall the speed of sound in water is about 5 times faster than in air. When I talk my sound waves in air, the wavelength of this sound will be about 3.4 meters. So that's one cycle of the sound. The same frequency in the water will have a cycle in 15 meters. So that goes much further. So the sound will go faster and further. That means that really water is a better environment for communication to happen. So obviously the animals in the environment have taken advantage of this.
This is the voice of a Weddell seal, which I recorded below the frozen surface of the Ross Sea in Antarctica. It's a male hanging head down in the darkness, singing to retain his harem of females.
Different animals make noise in a different way. Obviously the mammals, which are mammals like us, they use their larynx a bit like us to generate noise. But fishes, they don't have a larynx, right? So they've got actually different mechanisms as well. Some fishes have this bubble of air in them, which we call the swim bladder. That's really the primary function of this bubble of air, is to allow them to go up and down in the water column. But some fishes have special muscles that grow around this bubble and that really activates when they want to sing. And that means that it's like a drum. So that's how they produce sound. Some other fishes have some special teeth in the mouth, at the back of the mouth, that they can grind together, and that produces some sort of a rasp. And obviously you've got all the sounds that are produced by the byproducts. So like a sea urchin, you know, eating a little algae on a rock, that's going to produce a rasping sound as well.
This is the snap, crackle and pop of pistol shrimps, occasionally with the sounds of grunting cod. This is a pod of orca hunting with their echolocation pulses and contact calls. These are the hammering pulses made by an Arctic icebreaker 12 kilometres from my hydrophones.
The ocean is an ensonifying environment. It's full of sounds. And so the animals down there really have developed what they can to tune in to what they need, because it's quite chaotic. And every animal is also different. So it's important to distinguish the animals which have evolved from the early aquatic life forms. I'm thinking about invertebrates like the sea urchins, sea stars, octopus, and fishes like sharks and bony fishes. So it's important to distinguish this group from the marine mammals or the marine reptiles, which in the evolution they have had to use their hearing to the air and then they went back in the water. So these ears are very different from one another. So the invertebrates, jellyfish for example, they've got what we call a statocyst, which is a small organ like a sac, which have a little piece of rock in there. And this rock is much denser than the rest of the animal. And so that creates an inertia when a sound wave hits the animal. So that's how they can sense there is a vibration around. The fishes, they have actually a full vertebrate ear, so they have a labyrinth like we do, but they have something unique, which is called an otolith. An otolith is a very hard calcium carbonate structure, which has really the same function as the little rock in the jellyfish. So it's a different density that will vibrate when the sound wave hit them. Marine mammals, as mammals, they have a cochlea like us. The difference is that they don't have an eardrum. Why? Because an eardrum is only useful if you've got air on one end of the ear. Obviously, marine mammals are in the water, so there's no air. So what they have developed is some fatty tissue in the lower jaw, and this fatty tissue will actually conduct the sound in the environment through the bone to the inner ear, and that's how they can detect sound in the water. So there's all these different mechanisms that animals have developed during evolution to really take advantage of this whole sound environment. As humans, we are acoustically disabled, if you want, in the water. Our ears are very ill-adapted for the water environment. We get disorientated, and our brain is really not wired to process all this information properly. And that's because human ears is based on air conduction. So the sound waves travels into the ear canal and vibrate this eardrum. And that's then connected to the hearing center. Now, if you fill the outer ear with water, this doesn't work anymore. The drum cannot drum properly. So that's really why we become disabled. And that's probably why it is hard for us to realize that there is a whole other world down there.
In recording under the ocean surface with hydrophones, I've been able to tune into audio worlds inaccessible to many people. But one creature I've yet to record in close-up is the largest of them all, the blue whale. It's a mammal that's also enchanted the marine biologist and ocean educator Asha DeVos, whose work has taken her closer to these animals than I have ever been.
My name is Asha DeVos. I'm a marine biologist and ocean educator in Sri Lanka. I'm also the executive director and founder of OceanSwell, Sri Lanka's first marine conservation research and education organization. And our flagship project is the Sri Lankan Blue Whale Project, which is where my big adventure with the ocean really began. As a kid, I would see the ocean from afar and I would think, wow, there must be so much happening in there. There must be so much magic that we just don't understand. I would go to the museum in Colombo and there was a blue whale skeleton on the ceiling. And I would lie under it and I would think, wow, what is this creature? And what does it look like with its clothes on, right? Because it's a skeleton. Sir Arthur C. Clarke, who moved from the UK to beautiful tropical Sri Lanka to dive, would tell me stories of the ocean. This one particular story, I remember very clearly, he was like, so I was on this dive and this skin went past me and it was long and it kept going and it was brown and I was like, wow, so what was it? And he says, well, my dive had to end because I was running out of air and I had to come up. I was this kid left hanging on the edge of my seat. And I knew that there was something down there that I wanted to know more of. These big beasts out there that we just didn't know anything about, and I wanted to be the person to discover them. My first real foray with the oceans around Sri Lanka was this opportunity to get on board a whale research vessel that was circumnavigating the globe, stopping in the Maldives in Sri Lanka. With a fair bit of coercion and 3 months of non-stop emailing, I finally managed to get myself on that boat, which I'm obviously really proud about. And on this expedition, we were actually tracking sperm whales, and we were tracking them acoustically. So we had underwater microphones dropped in the water 24/7, basically collecting all the sounds of the ocean. And I remember at that time, you know, this sound was constantly played on loudspeaker within the vessel. And you just heard this clicking of the sperm whales and whatever noise existed in the ocean. We came from the Maldives and we came into Sri Lanka. And I remember there was this predominant noise of motors and ships and vessels. And there was all this anthropogenic noise. And I think, to me, that was the first time I was like, wow, like, you know what? This is so beautiful. There are these incredible animals that are out here. Sri Lanka is this undiscovered spot in terms of the ocean environment, but yet I could tell that the sounds of these animals were getting masked and covered by this human-made noise. And I was seeing these ships cruising through these areas, and I started to think, you know what, like, there's a lot of work that I need to do. And that's really kind of when I really woke up to the idea that whatever research I did had to have a focus on conservation. And that's kind of how it's been ever since. So this is the sound of a northern Indian Ocean blue whale. My story is very tightly intertwined with this incredible population of blue whales that lives around the shores of Sri Lanka. You know, why blue whales is a question that a lot of people ask me. And it is an interesting one, because when I was working on the whale research vessel, we were circumnavigating around Sri Lanka. And there was one particular day when I was off the southeast coast of the island. And while we do have, you know, these hydrophones or these underwater microphones in the water to track animals, we also had someone on deck looking out for signs of life during daylight hours. And on this particular day that of interest, I was the person up on deck. So I was standing out there in the sweltering hot sun. I could hear the sperm whales that we were tracking, because obviously we were playing it on the loudspeakers through the vessel. And I knew they were out there. And I was determined to be the person who found this pod of sperm whales, right? So standing and staring out into the sun. And, you know, the end of my shift is approaching. I'm thinking, wow, where are these whales? I want to be the one to see them. And then off in the distance, I see this tall, really powerful blow. And sperm whales have, you know, when they exhale or blow, that it's slanted off onto the left-hand side, because they have one blowhole on the left-hand sides of their heads. Whereas this one was this incredibly tall, vertical, powerful blow that could only have come from an animal that was incredibly huge. And at that point, I was super stoked, super excited. I grabbed the walkie-talkie, I called down to my captain, and I say, hey, Bob, we have to go 11 o'clock, you know, 2 kilometers. So we turn the vessel and start moving in the direction of these blue whales. And as we get closer and closer, I'm thinking to myself, you know, like, what's going on? Why is there a blue whale here? This is super exciting. I'm super nervous about losing sight of this animal, so I'm straining into the sun, tears rolling down my face. And then as we get closer, I start to think I'm losing my mind. Because it wasn't just one blue whale, but it was 6 blue whales in an area the size of a football field. And I'm thinking, wow, like, this is nuts. You know, these animals have us, the largest animals that have ever roamed the planet. They have 70% of the oceans to roam, but they're aggregating in this tiny spot in warm tropical waters, right? So at that moment, I was like, okay, what's going on? I was fresh out of undergrad, and I'm kind of like thinking through what might be going on. And I'm thinking, well, my professors and my textbooks told me that large whales like blue whales would normally go to cold waters to feed, but then they'd come to warm waters to breed and calve. And so for me at that point, I was like, wow, obviously these guys are mating. So I was like on the edge of my seat thinking I'd be the first person in the whole world to ever document blue whales mating. So I urged my captain to get closer and closer and closer to these animals. And as we get closer, I start to realize that they're not mating. and there's no calves, and they're just kind of hanging around at the surface and sort of diving and coming up. And I'm thinking, what on earth are they doing? They're kind of disappointing me, because here I was thinking my scientific career was about to skyrocket. And then, you know, I said to the captain, I said, can we just sit around and watch for a little bit longer? Because now I've taken them off course anyways. And, you know, 10 minutes later, we were rewarded with this gigantic patch of whale poop. And I was blown away. I was so psyched. And if you've never seen whale poop, please Google it, because it's bright red in color and it's the most beautiful thing in the world. I'm not even exaggerating. And it sounds a little obsessive, but it is absolutely true. And apart from the fact that it was beautiful, I realized that, you know, the fact that these animals were pooping here meant that they were feeding somewhere close. But, you know, my textbooks, my professors said they weren't feeding in warm tropical waters. And Sri Lanka is as warm and tropical as it gets. They should be going to cold waters, but they were not. And that was really my eureka moment, because I realized that this particular population was doing something very different. They had figured out how to feed in these waters that they weren't supposed to feed in. What we have out here are what we call pygmy blue whales, which I think is hilarious because they still grow to about 65, 70 feet. But blue whales, like all whales, communicate with sound. They see their world with sound. So they find their mates with sound. They find their partners. They keep their families together. Sound is the way they see the world that they live in. And their eyes are pretty useless over vast distances. So if you want to see the world like a blue whale, you just have to shut your eyes and start using your ears better. You can't help but marvel, like, how on earth, you know, do they live these lives? Can they do the things they do? Do they find enough food? And do they survive in these oceans that we are having more and more impact on?
Listening to Asha talk about her discovery of this population of blue whales off the coast of Sri Lanka is even more remarkable to me, because this is the largest animal that has ever lived. And yet, there is still so much more to discover about their complex lives.
Whales are actually ecosystem engineers, and their survival in the ecosystem allows all the other processes around them to work efficiently and effectively. Whale poop, which you'll notice is a theme in everything I talk about, but it is incredible in more ways than one. You know, whale poop is ocean fertilizer. So these animals will go to the depths of the ocean to feed. And that's a space where you get all these nutrients that you don't get in the surface waters, like iron and nitrogen. So they feed in these areas where there's all these beautiful nutrients. They come up to the surface with their sunlight and then they poop. And that sunlight and those nutrients are exactly what these tiny microscopic plants called phytoplankton need to grow and proliferate and then photosynthesize. And as they photosynthesize, they're producing 50% of the oxygen that we breathe. So I always tell people, like, every time you breathe, you have to remember to thank whales, because it might be the whale poop that fertilized that plant that allowed that oxygen to be generated that's allowing to keep you alive today.
Professor Christopher Clark from Cornell University has been studying sounds in the seas for longer than most people. He's a pioneering scientist in marine bioacoustics whose work has opened many minds to the challenges facing marine wildlife. First of all, Chris, could you just give me an idea about your career and how it developed with your study of marine mammals?
Well, first of all, I was into biomedical engineering with a specialty in hearing aids and auditory prosthetics. And I happened to meet a family that was heading off to Argentina on a National Geographic expedition to study southern right whales. And the next thing I knew, I was living in a tent on a beach. And the whales were, I could hear them breathing at night just outside my tent. And we ate every night outside under this Southern Cross. And it was spectacularly romantic, and it was idyllic. In that late fall, when I was 23 years old, Roger and Katie Payne, with whom I lived and worked with on that beach, gave me some hydrophones, and I put the hydrophones in the water and started listening, and I was mesmerized. I was listening to the whales, I was listening to the dolphins, I was listening to the killer whales, I was listening to the seals. And that was it. I never went back to medical school. I was completely captivated by this notion of being able to listen to, pay attention to, and understand the complexity of life in the ocean through sound. One of my first memories when I went out in a boat and I was snorkeling next to a whale that was a young adult female. She was probably about 40 feet long. And I came to the surface to catch a breath, and suddenly I felt underneath my flippers something pushing up against me, and she lifted me out of the water. And I was standing on her head, lifting me out of the water.
Wow.
And then I went down and I dove down again, and this time I went right up next to her eye, probably a foot or two away from her eye. And that was, that's when I fell in love. And realizing that once she turned and used one powerful stroke of her tail to move several body lengths away, maybe she was 60 feet away, I couldn't see her anymore. And that's where it really strikes you. It really brings home the fact that, oh, these animals can't see each other unless they're in very close proximity, but they can hear each other across the bay. And that's where this notion struck me that, oh, I see, they maintain their social network. These animals are in constant communication, calling, these contact calls that they're using, which are adapted to maintain this social connectivity. We would watch animals swim across the bay as though they had an absolute perfect map of the bay, but it was acoustically derived. It wasn't through their eyes, it was through their ears.
And these animals migrate great distances as well, don't they? Do you think they keep in touch during their travels?
In the early 1990s, I was given the immense privilege of having access to the U.S. Navy's underwater anti-submarine listening system. This was at the end of the Cold War, and it was through the access to these instruments. We began tracking singing whales throughout the North Atlantic and North Pacific Ocean. Little by little, we realized we could actually detect the reflections of their voices off of the continental shelves, off of the underwater sea mountains. So this is where you realize, oh, I see, these large, very low frequency infrasonic sounds. These are sounds so low that you and I can't hear them. These whales are using sounds for navigating and echo ranging. And it got to the point where I can actually detect the reflections of their songs not coming to me directly, just like my voice is now coming directly from my mouth to the microphone in front of me, that I could actually hear the reflection of their voices off of these underwater cliffs and mountains. So, of course, I'm thinking, whoa, yes, I'm an animal. I've been evolving in this ocean world for 7 million years. I lived to be 150 years old. My grandfather taught me and my grandmother taught me how to navigate in this big blue expanse of liquid. And all I have to do is listen long enough and I'll hear the echoes, and those echoes tell me where I am. So my conclusion is, just like you and I have visual maps, we can see our way home, we can see our way out of wherever we are, we can imagine we have something called a mind's eye. I think these whales have something called a mind's ear, where their sense of where they are in the world, their sense of self, is all derived by listening. It's as though they have a map of the ocean, like you would see in a topographical map.
Well, that's remarkable, very eloquent what you describe, because I now have this picture of this incredibly complex and richly harmonic acoustic environment under the surface of our seas and oceans. What happens when you introduce noise into that environment?
One can't listen to the ocean, to the voices of the whales or the voices of the dolphins, without being acutely aware that there's a lot of noise that's coming from us. The majority of global commerce travels on ships. So we have 50,000 ships out there in the ocean, most of them in the Northern Hemisphere, moving the goods and services from one place to another. We also have other massive noise sources, which are from when we explore for hydrocarbons beneath the seafloor. We set off explosions every 10 seconds or so. These are massive explosions of sound that then penetrate into the Earth's crust. And these are so prolific that what happens is that the ocean noise acoustic environment, as I like to refer to it, that acoustic environment becomes full of acoustic pollution. So what we find is the world in which these animals have available to them in order to communicate, to navigate, to find food, to maintain social networks, to detect predators, all the basic life functions that you and I are so used to carrying out primarily with our eyes, is seriously compromised because now I can't hear the reflections of my calls off of underwater mountains that help me navigate to my feeding areas or my breeding areas.
The picture there just sounds terrifying. Highly evolved sea mammals sort of suffer these conditions in their environment, animals that, as you say, rely on sound and vibrations to feed and to reproduce, because if you can't hear a potential mate, then as a species, you're in trouble.
This impacts so many facets of life. And the other part of this is the scale of the compromise. It's just not for a week now and then. In fact, for the case of vessel noise, shipping noise, it's constant. It's year-round, and it's decade after decade. So this is, it's not that whales are turning up dead on beaches just because they were exposed to shipping noise, although we do have cases of this happening where sonars or explosions from air guns are such that these animals are physically harmed, but the harm actually comes over the decades. So, for example, we have now species that are starving to death because they can't find enough food. And some of their inability to find food is most likely linked to the fact that they can't use their voices or their ears effectively to maintain the social cohesion of the group, of their society, of their culture. And then the consequences are not observed for decades. And it's not just the whales. One of the major concerns that's emerging out of this new knowledge we're gathering is that it's fishes. It's the food we eat and we rely on from the ocean that is being compromised by these insults that we throw into that world.
Since Chris Clark first started recording in the oceans, the number of scientists researching marine acoustics has steadily expanded. Science is increasingly paying attention to the sounds under the surface of the oceans. And although building up a body of evidence takes time, all the scientists that we've talked to for this series have agreed on one thing. Man-made noise pollution is having a significant impact on marine life. And we're still discovering the full extent of that impact. Decades after Chris Clark began his pioneering work, the baton of ocean acoustic research has been picked up by a new generation of scientists. In the next episode, we'll be travelling to Norway to listen in with some marine researchers who are inquiring how sound impacts on the underwater world. And we'll be exploring the unlikely role that artists such as myself could play in this ongoing investigation.
You can listen to the next two episodes of Oceans of Noise in the Science Weekly feed right now. The series is presented by Chris Watson and produced by David Waters. The executive producers are Catherine Godfrey and Shanida Scotland, with sound engineering by Pascal Wise. The commissioning editor is Tracy McVeigh. And thank you to all the scientists and artists that helped us to make the series. The podcasts are part of the Guardian's Seascape project, examining the health of the seas and the impact of fishing and pollution on our vast oceans. You can find more from that series by searching Seascape over at The Guardian.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, Just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.